And indeed, you're tuned in to Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. My name is V-Man, and I'll be your host for the next half hour until 6 o'clock. Today on Rockin' the Boat, I'm joined live in the studio by Rania Masri. She is coordinator of the Iraq Action Coalition and director of the Southern Peace Research and Education Center. She's also a national board member of Peace Action and a member of the board of directors of the Education for Peace in Iraq Center. She's going to be joining me in just a few moments for a live discussion on the United States military's use of depleted uranium weapons in Iraq and related issues to post-war Iraq. Stand by, stay tuned for Rockin' the Boat coming your way right now on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And probably at the last 10 minutes of the show, we'll take calls, and I'll give out the number at that time. Stand by. U.S. forces suffered about 350 casualties during the 1991 Gulf War, while tens of thousands of Gulf War personnel have come down with any of a number of disabling and life-threatening medical conditions, such as cancer, respiratory problems, neurological disorders, and the like. Hundreds have died. Casual observers say exposure to depleted uranium particles left over from spent munitions is a possible cause. The depleted uranium bullets are made of low-level radioactive nuclear waste material left over from the making of uranium fuel rods and weapons. It is 1.7 times as dense as lead and easily burns its way through armor. But it is controversial because it leaves a trail of contamination that has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, the age of our solar system. In the 1991 Gulf War, U.S. forces used about 320 tons of depleted uranium, much of it fired by A-10 aircraft. Some estimates suggest over 1,000 tons or more of depleted uranium was used in the current war in Iraq. Joining us to discuss this pressing issue is noted human rights advocate, environmental scientist, and author Rania Masri, coordinator of the Iraq Action Coalition and director of the Southern Peace Research and Education Center at the Institute for Southern Studies.
Yes, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Rania Masri is also a board member of Peace Action and a member of the board of directors of the Education for Peace in Iraq Center. From March 1998 to March of this year, she served as the Arab Women's Solidarity Association's representative to the United Nations. A widely published media commentator, Rania Masri contributed to the book Iraq Under Siege and has a chapter in the just-published book Iraq, Its History, People, and Politics. Her chapter in that book is titled Assault on Iraq's Environment, Radioactive Waste and Disease, The Effects of Depleted Uranium Weaponry and Blockade. Rania Masri is in Santa Cruz to participate in the Trans Local Forum on Feminisms and Global War being held today and tomorrow at UC Santa Cruz, and she joins us here live on Rockin' the Boat. Rania Masri, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, let's start by having you describe what happens when depleted uranium gets inside a human body.
Okay. Let me backtrack a little bit, though, and start. Earlier, you cited some statistics regarding Gulf War veterans, and I just want to make a few corrections. According to the Department of Veteran Affairs, the number, unfortunately, of U.S. soldiers who have been disabled either due to depleted uranium or due to other U.S. military activities in the 1991 Gulf War against Iraq is a lot higher than a few thousand. It is actually 149,000 Gulf War veterans who are right now on disability. So these are not the men and women who have applied for disability. These are the men and women who have actually been given disability by the Department of VA, which is, if we think about how many men and women actually applied, it would be a lot larger. In terms of the number of men and women, and these are primarily men who have died since 1991, unfortunately, it's not in the hundreds, it's actually in the thousands. And again, these are numbers according to the Department of Veteran Affairs, and I encourage anyone who really wants to look into this to go into the website of the National Gulf War Resource Center. There's excellent website on the impacts of Gulf War veterans. Now, to answer your question about what depleted uranium actually does to the system. it's basically like lead in the sense that it settles in the body like lead. And if we think about what lead does not, you know, when you inhale it or you ingest it, you don't really remove it from your body through regular bowel movements. So depleted uranium settles in your body, and it is known to cause numerous kinds of cancer in the body. It is regarded by the EPA as a radioactive waste that needs to be deposited like any other nuclear waste byproduct, which is what it is. So this, when we say depleted, that's kind of a false statement because we may think, well, it's really safe. But it's only partially depleted, so it's still radioactive. And according to Doug Roeke, the U.S. Army health physicist and the former Department of the Army and Department of Defense DU project director himself, and a man who right now is dying because of the impact of DU, he states, and I quote, he believes the use of DU munitions during war is a crime against God and humanity. And he states that among DU's adverse health effects for those who are exposed to DU, they include but are not limited to reactive airway disease, neurological abnormalities, kidney stones and chronic kidney pain, vision degradation, various forms of skin and organ cancer, uranium in semen, sexual dysfunction and impotence, and birth defects in offspring.
And these are just what we, you know, these are just minimal studies, correct? I mean, there hasn't been, you know, exhaustive studies on the use of depleted uranium and the effects.
There have been limited studies in the sense we have had Iraqi scientists themselves conduct studies. We have had Gulf War veterans who have had to leave the United States to go to Iraq to find out what is happening. We've also had numerous anecdotal evidence. If we look at what is happening in New Mexico for the Native Americans who mine uranium, if we look at what is happening in Puerto Rico, because depleted uranium was among the weapons that was tested in Vieques, if we look at what is happening in Afghanistan, if we look at what happened in Bosnia and Kosovo, and if we look at what has happened to the Italian veterans and the French veterans, both of the Gulf War and of the former, you know, the war in the former Yugoslavia, there's just a lot of anecdotal evidence out there. On top of that, the World Health Organization, which the Iraqi government, prior to this latest phase of the war, had constantly been requesting for the World Health Organization to actually go to Iraq and find out what is happening, was not allowed to go to Iraq to do intensive studies on this.
So we don't really know what the impact in Iraq has been. I mean, is there any...
Well, we know a minimal.
What are the statistics currently from the results of the 91 Gulf War in the last 12, 13 years? What what are the rates of cancer in Iraq now?
There's no countrywide rate that I can give you, but I can tell you in Basra, in southern Iraq, where we have had the largest amount of depleted uranium used, there has been a fivefold increase of leukemia for children in Basra alone. And when we just think about that, you know, we need to recognize that these increased rates of cancer had been taking place in a country whose healthcare system was deliberately destroyed by the 13-year sanctions. So it's not simply leukemia affecting, you know, white rich kids in Durham, North Carolina, where we have the highest per capita of doctors to civilians in the country. No, it is an increase of cancer in a country where morphine has been banned by sanctions, although morphine is the only drug that can ease the pain of cancer, where chemotherapy is banned by sanctions, where numerous other simple medication is banned by sanctions. And that's where we have had the increase of leukemia. We've also had an increase of breast cancer in children in Iraq, leading to girls as young as 14 and 15 having to have had mastectomies done. Wow. You know, whereas we look at it here, and unless you have breast cancer in your family, you don't need a mammogram done until you're 40. So imagine if you're 14 and you've had breast cancer and had to have a breast removed. Iraq is also the only country in the world where stomach cancer is actually increasing. And we don't know with regards to stomach cancer if this is directly related to depleted uranium, if it is related to the other diseases that have been widespread that we can't exactly pinpoint, if it's related to the poor nutrition, or if it's related to all of these things combined. We have also had studies by Iraqi scientists state that they believe depleted uranium has already been incorporated into the food chain in Iraq.
Wow. How does that happen? Can you describe, the United States uses this stuff in their munitions. They fire it off. It hits a suppose they fire a shell at a tank, and describe what happens.
Well, when it explodes, 70% of it becomes airborne. So if you think if you're in the area and you can't help but inhale it, Okay, then it affects you. It can settle into the soil, and then what happens? What if it's absorbed by the water? What if it's absorbed by the plants? We honestly don't fully know. But what we do know is, considering that the weapons used in 91 were simply surface weapons, basically, they were not weapons that went underground using depleted uranium. They were surface weapons. And still, Iraqi scientists have found that now DU has been incorporated into the food chain in the sense that it has been ingested by the soil and ingested by the vegetation. Now, considering that, and considering that now in this war, we do know that the bunker busters that were used, that were made by Raytheon and Lockheed Martin, specifically, no, I'm sorry, they were made by Lockheed Martin, not by Raytheon. These bunker busters that were used, according to the Lockheed Martin patent for these bunker busters, they stated in the patent that depleted uranium will be used in the bunker busters. And when they tested these weapons in New Mexico, they found that this weapon penetrates 150 feet below the desert floor. So if they use this weapon in Iraq, which most likely they did use this weapon in Iraq, now we not only have depleted uranium on the surface, we have it 150 feet below the desert floor, which means it may have already impacted the water table. It's really horrific. We don't really know the full extent. There was one report that I read that now states that 50% of the Iraqi population is now prone to getting cancer. Now, maybe that's an exaggeration. Maybe it's only 10%. Okay, 10%. That's still something. I mean, what is a number that we as Americans will feel comfortable with?
And I should just point out, 10% of a country the size of Iraq, 24 million people is the estimate there. Yes. Right now. That's 2.4 million people.
Yes.
We're talking about. That's just with the low estimate, right?
Well, I just threw out 10% right there, you know, in the sense that the 50% statistics came from scientists in England. They were the ones who came up with the statistic of 50%. So if we find that number to be too horrific to accept, I simply ask the listeners, what number do we find to be, you know, acceptable for our conscience? The fact that depleted uranium is still being used by our military, it is still being tested by our military, primarily on people of color communities, and it is still being sold by our government to other countries that will then use it in other acts of war.
We're speaking with Rania Masri. She's the noted human rights activist, environmental scientist, and author, and coordinator of the Iraq Action Coalition and director of the Southern Peace Research and Education Center. She joins us live here in our studios at Free Radio Santa Cruz. I wanted to ask you another question about this, and I guess, what warning systems are in place for civilians inside Iraq and in the U.S. military for personnel, you know, that are going to be around this stuff?
I don't know if any warning systems that are in place. I don't know if any, actually. And what makes it even more dangerous is when you have communities in which depleted uranium is now airborne, of course, they can't go anywhere. But in other places, you have these bullets that are basically still, you know, radioactive with depleted uranium. And what children typically do in war zones is they actually pick up the remnants of these bullets, the remnants of the bombs, and it's a decoration. I mean, I'm a Lebanese American, and I can tell you my own family in Lebanon, during the war, they used to pick up these bullets and used to have them as decoration in the sense of, oh, this is a bullet from this weapon, and so on. And we know that in Iraq, this is what children had been doing throughout the war. So if we imagine now, not only is it airborne, but now it's actually being brought into people's homes. It is something. It is something to really tremendously worry about. And I have to stress that this weapon is on top of the already destroyed health infrastructure. It's on top of, right now, the United Nations is worried that millions of Iraqis may starve to death because their agriculture has been completely destroyed. It's on top of the thousands, literally thousands of cluster bombs that the United States alone used just in this war. And cluster bombs are basically landmines that primarily target children. And this is on top of all this. So it's not as if we were using this weapon against a country that is fine otherwise for this weapon. We're using it against a country. We had been using it against a country that had been destroyed economically and from a healthcare perspective and from an educational perspective.
Last month, a Pentagon spokesman told the BBC that it has, quote, no plans to do a DU cleanup in Iraq. Yes. Two questions come to mind. How is DU contamination cleaned up? And what international standards are there, you know, for the United States to be responsible for cleaning up the mess that's left behind after a conflict?
Well, Doug Roke stated last week in another interview, he stated, quote, for each and every vehicle that is struck by a single uranium munition, you have to take that entire vehicle and physically remove it. Then you have to clean up all the uranium penetration that is left around the vehicle. Then you have to take a bulldozer and go out to at least 100 meters and scrape down to at least 10 centimeters and remove all of that dirt in order to make that area safe again. Now, we're talking literally about an expenditure of billions and billions of U.S. dollars. We may say, well, that's simply too much money. However, it is the United States' legal responsibility to clean up this mess. It is not simply something that, well, we may not be in the mood to do. It is literally our legal responsibility to do. And with respects to billions and billions of dollars, if we look at how much money the United States government has allocated for the production of military weaponry to assist in the war profiteering of certain companies in this country that directly then benefit Rumsfeld and Cheney, who are still getting money from Halliburton, for example, and Bechdel and numerous other companies, then we need to keep all this in perspective when we think about priorities.
Why then is the U.S. deliberately using a known toxic substance, and is it a war crime?
Yes. There are numerous elements, numerous communities, and I believe one United Nations agency that is a member of the UN General Assembly that does consider the use of depleted uranium to be a war crime, yes. Why is the United States using it? Well, one, it's a very powerful weapon. It's a weapon. Depleted uranium could be replaced with tungsten, and it could be just as powerful to destroy tanks, minus the environmental hazards, but tungsten is more expensive than depleted uranium. Second, depleted uranium is basically a recycling method for this nuclear enrichment process. So you've got all this radioactive waste. What do you do with it? Shall you spend a lot of money dumping it in the ground, or shall you make a lot of money making it into a weapon and then sell it abroad? So there is that element. Third, the United States military-industrial complex is in the business of making weapons and selling them. It is not in the business of making safe weapons. It's in the business of making weapons.
Recently, George W. Bush, our unelected president, a couple weeks ago, he was in Santa Clara, and he gave a talk at United Defense Industries. He stood in front of a life-size photo of a Bradley fighting vehicle. Of course, United is the maker of the Bradley and the Howitzer tanks. Also, they're involved in the use of depleted uranium. Bush stated, quote, "We are proud of everybody who wears the nation's uniform, and we are proud of those who have contributed to the defense of this country, just like the people right here at United Defense have done. The technologies and products developed here at United Defense have made our military second to none. So I'm here to thank the folks who work for this fine company on behalf of the American people for your contribution to the security of your nation and for the peace of the world," end quote. Rania, what are your thoughts about the role United Defense Industries plays in keeping peace in the world?
I don't really believe that a weapons manufacturing industry can keep the peace. I don't believe that peace is kept through weaponry, because the production of weaponry simply encourages further production of weaponry. And once you're in the business of producing weapons, guess what? You need to be in the business of using the weapons so that you can continue to produce the weapons. And if you're in the business of producing weapons, means you have to be in the business of supporting wars. So in no way, shape, or form do I consider United, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, or any of those weapons manufacturers to be keeping the peace. Furthermore, when we look at, for example, Lockheed Martin, which is the largest manufacturer of numerous kinds of weapons in this country, and we take into credit its extremely anti-union record and its anti-black record, then it makes us wonder. And then when we take into consideration that these military contracting companies, now under the new laws, are exempt from environmental regulations when they produce weapons, it means how are they keeping the peace if they're keeping the community dirty and polluted? Furthermore, I'm really appalled to hear George Bush say he supports the troops, because I firmly do not believe that this administration supports the troops or has any respect for soldiers or has any respect for veterans. Just a few weeks before the Supreme Court-appointed president and the Supreme Court-appointed administration sent our boys and girls, as they are referred to by the corporate media, to Iraq to commit these killings, just a few weeks before that, Bush cut more than $250 million from the healthcare budget of the Department of VA. So this does not strike me as the act of a president who actually has any respect for the veterans. Instead of increasing the budget of the health care, instead of taking care of veterans when they come home, instead of making sure that we don't have a single veteran who is homeless in this country, we have quite the contrary record.
Again, we're speaking with Rania Masri, noted environmental noted human rights advocate, environmental scientist, and author. She's joining us live here in the studios at Free Radio Santa Cruz. We have about 10 minutes left, and in a few minutes, I'm going to open up the phones and try to take a couple questions. You can call in at 427-3772. You mentioned the media. I'm looking here at a story in the USA Today. It was published May 6th, just a couple weeks ago. It's titled, "Depleted Uranium Shells Pose No Danger to Iraqis." And it quotes Lieutenant Colonel Michael Sigman, Deputy Surgeon for the U.S. Army's V Corps. He says, quote, "There is not really any danger, at least that we know about, for the people of Iraq." He went on to say, "Children playing with with expended tank shells would have to eat and then practically suffocate on the depleted uranium residue before any health problems occurred." Your response, Rania?
My response is obviously that military official has not read U.S. Army documents themselves. The U.S. Army stated in its documents dating back to 1990 that depleted uranium is a toxic weapon and its toxicity cannot be altered or changed. It's a direct quote. And there's numerous other scientific reports made by the United States Army itself stating the effects of depleted uranium. And I also am really puzzled, not really puzzled, but I'm always upset when we have a newspaper such as this quote somebody who's clearly not objective and who clearly has an agenda and who definitely is not going to go on record saying DU is bad for people while he's still in the business of using depleted uranium and while he is still tied to a military industrial complex that continues to produce and sell them. So they should have asked at least somewhat of an independent scientist, and they should have asked Doug Roeke, who is the U.S. Army expert on depleted uranium. And if depleted uranium really were not so dangerous, then what is killing Doug Roeke right now as we speak?
This article is indicative of a problem in the mainstream media. This is the only other person that they quote is Major, also in the military, the V Corps Command, Sergeant Major Ken Preston, who also goes on to justify the use of the military's use of depleted uranium. What else can you say about the media in regards to this issue?
Well, if we look at the corporate media in totality, if we look at CNN, Fox, MSNBC, and all the newspapers, doing a LexisNexis study, we realize that there has been almost no discussion about depleted uranium by the corporate media, almost no discussion. They would just state it and not discuss what it is, if they would state it at all. There has also been almost no discussion of cluster bombs by the same corporate media, although cluster bombs is banned by international law. And so the use of cluster bombs is clearly an illegal act. So whereas depleted uranium right now is still a legal weapon to use, cluster bombs are not a legal weapon to use. And yet in both of these cases, we did not see the corporate media discussing them. And again, we should not be surprised because it was the same media agencies, again, the TV networks and the newspapers, including the New York Times, that built up this threat of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, surrounded us with hypothetical scenarios to scare us into supporting the war, changed the support of the war from WMDs to so-called liberating the Iraqi population, and now is not even bringing up the fact that they can't even find any weapons of mass destruction on the ground in Iraq, even though Ari Fleischer, the White House spokesperson, said days into the war that weapons of mass destruction remains the reason for the war. So this is coming from the same corporate media. We really should not be at all surprised.
And just to add to that, I mean, lately we've been seeing streams of video footage and still photos in the newspapers of images of Iraqis digging up mass graves said to be from the Saddam Hussein regime. But we're not seeing images of Iraqi dead that are being shot down in nonviolent demonstrations, that were gunned down by military personnel on their way to Baghdad, that were killed in bombings. I mean, we're not seeing these images yet. We're getting constantly reminded by our media here in the U.S. that, you know, the Saddam Hussein regime, even though they've been out of power now for over a month, you know, how we're just constantly reminded about that. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. My name is the V-Man. This is Rockin' the Boat. I'm joined by Rania Masri. We did have a caller, but they hung up as I was about to pick it up. So if you want to try back, the number in the studio is area code 831-427-3772. We have about 6 minutes left in the program, so we would definitely encourage you to call in now. Let's talk a little bit about the sanctions. As you stated that in addition to the depleted uranium, the effects of the sanctions have caused upwards of over a million deaths since the Gulf War in 91. We have things like paper clips, kettles, calculators, pliers, wax, thermometers, baking soda, aspirin. These are just a few of the thousands of items not allowed into Iraq as a result of sanctions. Mm-hmm. What are the motives of the United States in banning these particular items?
Well, one thing that we have to be very clear is there is no banned list. There is no list of items that are banned into Iraq. There's simply a list of items that have not been allowed into Iraq. And so that you know, there is that technical difference that we as activists just need to be a little bit wary about. Now, as to what is the reasoning, well, using the United States military logic, okay, if we are going to accept their logic, being A, that these weapons are dual-use items in the sense that these items could potentially be used to produce a weapon of some kind. Basically, the way I look at it is anything can be used to produce a weapon of some kind. Anything. So there is that element. There also is, if we're going to look at this from a very cynical perspective, that if the objective is to destroy the Iraqi economy and to make it extremely dependent on other countries for its survival, then yes, it does seem logical to destroy its educational base, since Iraq's education was the number one education in the Arab world, to destroy that base, to destroy its factories, to destroy its agriculture, to make it into the country that right now the U.S. is working to make it into. We need to recognize that what the U.S. government is doing in Iraq is not simply an occupation, but it is more than that. The U.S. is on its pathway to privatize Iraqi oil. The United States has already canceled the Iraqi dinar in Iraq and replaced it with the U.S. dollar. Now imagine if within 1 minute the U.S. dollar becomes obsolete in this country, what will happen to your savings? What will happen to your money? Now you're even more impoverished than you were before. So think about what's happening to Iraq from that aspect. Think about what will be the impact on Iraq's economy from the privatization of its own natural resources on top of the $300 billion that the Iraqi people are still being forced to pay in foreign debts. When we look at that and we combine it to what the sanctions have done to the country for 13 years, we then see quite clearly that there is a plan to transform Iraq from a first world nation that was rather independent, that was working towards even greater independence, to another typical third world nation that will be indentured and that will serve as cheap labor and free natural resources to serve the corporations around the world.
And now we see the United States pushing a plan to lift the sanctions on Iraq after 13 years. Will the lifting of the sanctions adequately address all these problems that we're talking about? I mean, simply lifting the sanctions.
Well, I have to say, it's a very uncomfortable position that I find myself in as an activist who's been working for 7 years, 8 years, to lift the sanctions on Iraq. I'm right now in a position where I don't feel comfortable with the lifting of the sanctions, because the question becomes, who is in charge of the Iraqi national resources? So you lift the sanctions and you make the United States, under the fig leaf of the United Nations, in charge of the Iraqi national resources. Will that mean that the Iraqis themselves will have a higher standard of living? I don't think that's necessarily going to be the case. Maybe there's a small chance that they will, simply on a public relations perspective. But more so, I believe it is a pathway for the United States to steal Iraqi national resources.
And I guess just in the last few moments that we have, what are the prospects for democracy, by the Iraqi people? And what can we here in the United States do to affect the situation on the ground there in Iraq?
Well, again, we have to recognize that the U.S. government, even in its stated policies, does not want a democracy in Iraq, nor are they working towards a democracy in Iraq. We also need to recognize, though, that the Iraqi people are simply not going to lie down on their backs and allow this to happen. And if we look at Iraqi history, we have seen since the year 954, Iraq has been continually occupied and continually liberated by its own population. So there has not been an occupation in Iraq that has been managed to control and subvert the Iraqi population. So the American forces will be kicked out. I have no doubt that the Iraqi people will rise up and liberate their own land and seek their own freedom. The question that we need to struggle with is how many Iraqis and how many American troops will die in the meantime? What will happen to Iraq during the period? What will happen to Iraq afterwards? What is our responsibility as Americans? first and foremost, to reclaim our own democracy here in this country. We desperately need to do that. We desperately need a regime change. And what I mean by regime change is not to remove Tweedledum Bush and replace him with Tweedledum Gore or somebody else who's being supported by the Democratic Party. No, it's actually to reclaim our democracy, to have a viable democracy, which means we as American citizens need to get off our butts and need to do a lot of work, a lot of community building, a lot of organizing, and a lot of really inspiring, empowering work. And when we look at the struggles that have taken place in this country, from the abolition movement to the civil rights movement to the suffrage for women to numerous others, I mean, the labor movement, there's a lot of empowering struggles that have taken place in this country. We get our strength from them, and it's about time that we do another empowering, liberating struggle to liberate our own country from the corporations that are right now running it.
That's the voice of Rania Masri. She's joining me here live in the studio. She is the coordinator of the Iraq Action Coalition on the web at iraqaction.org.
Yes.
Rania, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Vinny.
And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, Rocking the Boat, signing off.
My name's Michaelo. I like to play with shiny toys. I'm just a child like other little boys. What's leukemia? Won't somebody tell? Is it as pretty as this little bullet shell? My name is Hanan, I'll be dead within a year. But if I could speak, and if somehow you could hear, I'd ask some questions, maybe some that you could answer. Like, what's uranium, and why was I born with cancer? And I'm Juanita, for me life's been short and strange. Born with no arms here beside the bombing range. They call it DU, the stuff that made my life this way. My parents were arrested at the protest yesterday. I have no name on this military base. Born and died here, a child without a face. To serve his country, my father went off to war. But it followed him home, back to the Mississippi shore. Poisoned children of the earth. And I will haunt you wherever you give birth. In the war zones, whichever side you're on. Cause the dust is never settled once the battle's dead and gone. Yes, I'm the future of a planet on its knees. Radiation, sickness, and disease. I'm all the armies, I'm the life that couldn't be. And when you see another baby, think of me. When you see another baby, think of me. You see another baby, think of me.